Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Garrett Hudson is my guest today, but before, as always, we have Justine. How are you doing today, Justine?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Things are fabulous.
I'm hoping we don't revisit those technical difficulties we had last week.
Yes, people were asking about that. They were concerned. You're okay. Just some computer problems.
Well, only my computer's fall and break. So I'm here today, and with luck, I will continue to be here for as long as possible. You know, when I was on a cruise, I turned a review in every week, and here we are back, and I got nothing else to do, and I couldn't get the review recorded properly.
Well, I'm glad everything, you're back.
Yeah. So you and I met on the Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense group on Facebook.
Yes, we did.
And you had joined it because you were in the process of writing your first book, Body in a Bathhouse, which was well received all around. And I remember you posted a couple of covers and asked for advice on the covers. And I joined the group as a reader of Gay Mysteries. And it is often where I get recommendations from. There are a lot of authors like you on the group. And another author on the group, Greg Ash, recommended this new book called Fools Rush In by Austin Thomas Burton.
And I want to say something to the listeners about this group. It's a great group because you have authors and readers in there. You can chat amongst each other. People recommend books. And it's not like of other Facebook groups where it's nothing but authors promoting their books, one after another after another. It's limited how frequently an author can promote their book. So it's a good group.
Yeah, and many authors don't promote their group as often as it's, or their book as often as it's allowed. I mean, I think the promotions are limited to one a week. And rarely do you see a book coming up week after week.
That's true.
I think there is a natural flow to the group that you have to put the limit on for the people who are just there to promote. But in general, it's a group where there's a lot of discussion and excitement about new books and excitement about awards. And on the group, Greg Ash recommended this book, which came out a couple of weeks ago. I had tried to review it last week. And he said it was a twisty mystery. In the acknowledgments of the book, the author thanks Greg for his pushing him to get the book done and out. And another name we both know was also thanked, Matt Lubbers Moore. Mm-hmm. Matt is a partner in Recurred Tales, in which I'm also a partner. And he is one of the moderators of the Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense group.
And he's been a guest twice on the show.
He is. Okay, let's move on to this week's review.
Okay.
It's called Fools Rush In by Austin Thomas Burton. It is his first book. It received a number one bestseller in the Gay Mystery category on Amazon. It's also available on Kindle Unlimited. The main character is Horatio Owen, and he's called Rush by his friends. He went through the police academy and was caught in flagrante delicto with another cadet just before graduation. His father was a police officer and asked him not to join the force. So he ends up going up to his grandfather's and gets his private investigator's license. Now his grandfather has died, his father has died, and he is down in San Diego with an active PI license, but running a gay bar.
Well, that's quite a busy man.
He is quite a busy man. So somebody tries to fix him up on a date with a real estate developer, and he decides he's not going to do it. He hears a news story that the developer's hotel, he's remodeling the old hotel, Hotel Cortez, in San Diego, and they found a body walled up in one of the closets. So he's tending bar one day, and his father's old partner, who's now on the short list for chief of police, comes in and asks him to please investigate this death from 20 years ago.
It's not often you find a body in a wall.
Yeah, body in a wall, right. And the book is set in the 1990s. He tries not to take it. The police officer convinces him to. And then over the course of the next couple days, the real estate developer comes in and asks him to hire him for the same case. Then the local mafia drug lord comes in and tries to hire him on the same case. And it's just one thing after another. Apparently, he's the only person in town who can solve this mystery.
Well, with all that, he has no choice but to do it.
He's got no choice to do it. I mean, you've got somebody on the short list for police chief. And the local mafia guy all kind of bearing down. And so he gets involved in this mystery, and everybody he talks to ends up getting beat up after he talks to them. It sounds unbelievable. He's got, you know, all these big people are coming in and doing it. But within the book, it is all very plausible. He writes it so that you really believe that it's his involvement ends up making sense. There is indeed a reason why he's the only one that they want involved in solving this murder.
Ah, there we go.
And that's about all I can give you without giving away too many spoilers. It also involves him, another big player in the people who want him to solve the mystery is an aging drag queen. So he goes through a lot of different worlds and discovers they're all interconnected.
And as always, all the books you review are 5-star, but you also give them another rating.
This one gets an intriguing recommendation.
Intriguing.
It is, as Greg said, a twisty mystery, and I love twisty mysteries. And at the end, all the pieces fit together.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. All of the characters are well-defined and all are very interesting.
So it's Fool's Rush In by Austin Thomas Burton.
That's right.
Anything else this week?
No, that's it. Talk to you next week, Brad.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, GameMysteryPodcast.com. My guest, Garrett Hudson, writes upmarket mysteries and historical spy fiction driven by characters who are moving and unforgettable. He lives in Indianapolis with his husband, 4 adorable dogs, 2 oddball cats, and more fish than you can count. Garrett is an infrequent poster but frequent lurker on Twitter and Facebook. You can contact him or sign up for his monthly newsletter on his website, which I'll have in the show notes. Hello, Garrick.
Hello.
You're an animal lover. That's quite a houseful.
Yes, it is. And we don't live in a very big house either, so it really feels like a houseful sometimes.
Oh, I can only imagine. Well, we're going to start. Your most recent release is Spy Tango, which came out last month. This is your second second Martin Schuller novel, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. It's a series of novels around an American spy catcher in the World War II era, although the first couple of novels happened right before the U.S. gets involved in the war, when it's still a European affair and we aren't actually involved in it. And there was some very interesting counterintelligence stuff happening in the U.S. at that time. There was significant pro-Nazi movement that was using propaganda and also trying to infiltrate defense industries and send information back to the fatherland. And we had some counterintelligence operations in the State Department and also in the FBI that were trying to infiltrate those groups and created a certain amount of drama that I thought would be good for a spycatcher series.
Now, you're saying the pro-Nazi movement was here in the United States?
Yes, there was a significant group in New York that even had a large rally in Madison Square Garden in February of 1939. Over 22,000 people attended, and there were some protests out in front of Madison Square Garden that turned a little bit violent even and was covered in the newspapers. It was quite a big deal at the time.
22,000 people? How come I didn't know this?
Yeah, it doesn't get covered very often in history books.
No, obviously it doesn't. Tell us about what kind of person Martin Schuller is.
Martin Schuller is not a very talkative individual. He's not particularly outgoing, a little bit more introverted, very analytical and intelligent, which is what makes him very good at infiltrating and analyzing data so that he can go undercover and infiltrate these groups and find the spies among them.
In your bio, you state that you write upmarket mysteries and historical spy fiction. Help us understand what upmarket means.
Okay. There's always been a sort of a false dichotomy, I think, between genre fiction and literary fiction. The narrative was always that literary fiction is more character-driven and genre fiction is more plot-driven. And in reality, I think that's not always true. There's a little bit of a spectrum in there, really. And upmarket is the term that is often used for genre books, like mysteries, for example, that are more character-driven, less formulaic, more about the internal life of the character and stories that couldn't possibly be written from the point of view of any different character.
So a little bit of both worlds.
A little bit of both worlds,
or
yes.
Or both genres, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
Now is the time to sell your novel. Tell us about Spy Tango more specifically.
Okay. In the first book in the series, Martin Schuller disobeyed some orders from his boss. And as a result of that, he gets sent out of the country and has to go down to Buenos Aires. He's put back into the Foreign Service down there. So it's a little bit of being sent into exile. But of course, in 1940 in Argentina, there was a lot of Nazi infiltration because there was a fairly large German community in Buenos Aires and other parts of Argentina. Mm-hmm. And there was also a lot of raw material in Argentina that the German war machine wanted. And it was not legal to get war material out of the neutral American countries. There was an agreement that had been struck between all the different republics in the Americas, other than Canada, because Canada was involved in the war, that prohibited sending war material to any of the belligerent nations. And Germany tried to smuggle things out of Argentina and Brazil and certain other countries. And so they had spies in those countries organizing smuggling rings. And I have Martin get involved in that and trying to break up one of the smuggling rings.
As you alluded to, most of your stories do take place in the 30s and the 40s. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you have a real passion for that time period. What about that era appeals to you?
You know, I grew up watching old movies from that time period, and there's just something about that that seems very appealing to me, the look and the feel of that era. So it's enjoyable to me to set characters and stories there.
Well, I know the fashions were great.
Yes, they were. It wasn't always bleak. The Depression was going on, but it wasn't always bleak.
Okay, so we know that the World War II era excites you, but you also have a general passion for LGBTQ history, especially pre-Stonewall. Do you happen to have a story that you can tell us that few people would know?
Yeah, actually, in the 1930s that we've been talking about, there was a gay and lesbian community that was fairly active in the Washington, D.C. era. With the New Deal and when Franklin Roosevelt came into the White House, there was a big expansion of the national bureaucracy. And so there were a lot of people that came into Washington from all over the country, and there was a big expansion of people, which a lot of people who had never been exposed to any other gay and lesbian people suddenly found that there were others like them there. And they started to band together and create a little bit of a community. And there were actually gay bars active in the area, as well as there were people that would come together at the YMCA or out on the National Mall or Lafayette Park right by the White House. There were gay gatherings. And I found that very interesting when I came across that. And I thought that would be something interesting to include in some of the books that I write.
Now, how big of a community was that? It sounds like it was pretty large.
Yeah, definitely in the thousands. I don't know that I've seen any specific number, but it was a sizable community, one big enough to support three gay bars.
And they were openly gay? It wasn't a hidden, like in some of the other cities where it was kind of disguised as a straight bar because nobody knew really what was going on?
There was some of both, actually. I would call it semi-closeted more than closeted. There were a lot of people who, particularly effeminate gay men, were very open about their femininity. And there was a bit of a reputation at the State Department for hiring a lot of those such people. And I think that's because, you know, wherever you get a gathering of gay people, other gay people want to join them. And so for whatever reason, the State Department kind of became one of those places. And the gay men who worked at the State Department sometimes called themselves the Fine Sisters, and others called them Fairy Boys and whatnot. But it was known. It was not super secret.
That's really surprising. I know the YMCA historically has been kind of a hidden spot for people to go, but to actually have gay bars is really surprising.
Yeah. And our mainstream histories don't really cover that. And when McCarthyism got going in the late 1940s, one of the first targets was actually homosexuals in the State Department and the Army. Even before he started digging into communism specifically, he was trying to root out what he called deviance.
Well, I know, I wish I could remember the movie, but it was very interesting where they talked about gays in the military during the war. And at the beginning of the war, they were very much accepted and were given, jobs like working the stores on the ships or actually putting on shows. And it was about halfway through the war that changed.
Right. There wasn't even a ban on homosexual activity in the military until late in 1942.
It was really that long. Wow.
Yeah.
So it started out great and then everything changed.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned to me off the air that you have some interesting stories about a king or kings. I want to hear about that.
Yeah, there were various kings through history that we believe now were probably gay or bisexual. And it's difficult to say for certain since they didn't really have those definitions back in those days. They wouldn't have necessarily thought of themselves that way. It was much more about behavior and something that somebody did rather than something that somebody was. But we believe that King James I of England was probably having a romantic and sexual relationship with the Duke of Buckingham. Henry III of France, this one I find very interesting. He actually had a group of favorites that were called the Mignons, who were youngish, late adolescent boys, usually from the lower nobility, and he always surrounded himself with them, and they were very fashionable, and they had a reputation for being gossips, sometimes vicious gossips, and he would elevate them to very high ranks, even though they hadn't done any services for the state or anything like that, and it's widely believed that he was probably involved with some of them.
So they were doing services, but not of the state.
Different kinds of services. Yeah.
Well, I know during like the 1700s and 1800s, men were very open about their relationships as far as being friends and would use the term love between just two friends. And so it confuses people to think that they were in a gay relationship when in reality they may not have been. Is that similar to what was going on back then, or is this a little more... we know it's more likely it was going on.
It's difficult to say with any certainty. We do have a few examples, like Edward II of England back in the 14th century was actually executed at his wife's orders, and he was executed in a way that was generally reserved for sodomists. A rather gruesome method, which I'll let people Google, and I won't get into it. But it was a specifically homosexual type of execution method, and so that's very intriguing.
That is interesting. Wow. Well, we're going to take a moment for, you know what time it is.
Oh, boy.
It's time to spin the wheel.
All right.
Okay. Are you ready for awkward questions authors get?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Okay. Well, sit back and relax while I spin the wheel here. Okay. Yours is kind of a fun one. Your awkward question is, are you as socially inept as all writers?
Oh, I hope not. But maybe sometimes.
Well, sometimes if you have a lot of animals.
It's true.
Don't necessarily get along with people, but we won't believe that about you.
No, I am a bit of a homebody sometimes, and my husband is too, and we're both a little bit introverted, but we do have friends that we enjoy going out with and spending time with as well, and I think it's interesting that we're all thought of as being socially inept, but really, we get our energy from being alone sometimes and being alone in our own thoughts, but we still enjoy being around people as well.
Yeah, there's a difference between being introverted and being inept.
Yes. And,
I don't think it's true of all writers, but I think as a rule, we tend to be more introverted.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we couldn't sit for long hours writing novels.
Absolutely.
Now, you say when you write that you like to fill in the gaps that history leaves out.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
You know, I came across a quote on Twitter several months back now that talked about how LGBT folk have been redacted from history. And that really stuck with me. I can't remember who said it, unfortunately. I cannot take credit for that one. But I think it's true. We have always been around in all times and places, but we haven't been written about. Whether that was on purpose or just merely through negligence, probably both. But especially until the 20th century, our presence wasn't really recorded. And again, some of that is because they didn't have the vocabulary for it. We didn't really think of sexual orientation or sexual preference as things until the very late 19th century. Prior to that, like I said, it was just something people did. And it was a shameful thing that people did. And so it was not talked about or written about in polite circles. And so, unfortunately, then we have a gap in the historical record that we have to kind of look for clues to find ourselves in history.
Well, to fill in those gaps, do you also happen to use real people from history in your novels?
I try not to too much, mostly because I don't feel comfortable fictionalizing real people and being confident that I could get it right. But I have, on occasion, I actually have written a manuscript which hasn't been released about the court of Henry III in the late 16th century in France, and that group of mignons that he had around him. And I really enjoyed that story, and I will get it back out again at some point and revise it and get it ready for publication.
Well, you kind of alluded to this, but what are the ethics of writing about historical figures?
I have a very high standard as far as wanting to always be historically accurate whenever possible. And I do take a few liberties here and there, but whenever I do, I try to make them really small liberties and things that don't really change the historicity of the story too much. And I think especially if you're going to be writing about real people, you really want to do a lot of research about what they were like, and even if possible, read their personal correspondence and try to get into the type of language they used and draw their personality from that. And especially when you get further back in history than about the 19th or 20th century, it's hard to find that correspondence. And I don't feel comfortable just making it up on the fly necessarily about somebody who was a real person about whom I can't say too much definitely.
Yeah, I understand that. My novels take place today, and I use real figures, but they pass through. Because you can get in trouble, especially since, you know, I can't say what the person would say or do. Mm-hmm. So they're just thrown in there to give some realism. Probably what you do with the historical figures, the few that you write in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not major characters by any means. They just kind of come in very briefly and then they go on their way again.
Now, what is one of the most interesting things you've learned in your historical research?
Oh, gosh. How common it was for gay and lesbian folk to actually find one another in different places. You know, between, especially in the interwar period in the 20s and 30s, there was in Bohemian societies in particular, there was a lower regard for traditional mores. And so there was a lot of gay and bisexual activity sometimes in Bohemian cultures, which again is something that they don't really write about too much. So you found that in Paris in the 20s, for example, and in Greenwich Village in New York and Harlem as well. The Harlem Renaissance had a strong gay element to it as well. And I think that's interesting. And again, something we don't hear about often enough.
I think Chicago was similar in that way, wasn't it, in some areas?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, L.A. was a little more conservative. It was when L.A. was actually a very conservative city. So when Hollywood moved in, people were not very happy about it. In fact, they had neighborhood brigades that would walk around. They worked with the police department looking for lewd behavior going on in the neighborhood. So you wouldn't think L.A. would have been in that mix, but at that time period, it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. And yet the part of the reaction to that too was they organized in the 50s in California earlier than they did anywhere else in the country. And that's where you got the Mattachine Society.
That is true. Mm-hmm. But there were other groups that were raided. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Which probably happened everywhere. Mm-hmm. What in your research has made you laugh?
Boy, let me think about that. You know, I've read about some interesting characters. I'm trying to think if any of them have made me laugh. There was a gay bar in Washington, D.C., whose name is escaping me right at the moment, of course, that had drag shows. And they had a couple of small-built women that were not only the waitresses, but also acted as the bouncers. And military men would come in there sometimes in the 30s and 40s, and it had a reputation of having a little bit of rough trade. And there were sometimes bar fights that would break out between members of the different services, Army versus Navy or whatever. And these two small built young women would get in between these great big sailors and push them apart. And I found that kind of humorous. And I actually did write a scene in one of my books, taking that as inspiration.
Well, that's a great story. Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about your Martin Schuller series, mm-hmm. but you also have two novels in your Death in Shanghai series.
I do, yeah.
Did you want to talk a little bit about those and how they're different?
Sure. Yeah, now those are murder mysteries, and they take place in Shanghai in the 1930s, which was a really interesting time in Shanghai. There was a very diverse community there, and actually there's... The darker side of that was several different European nations and Japan actually had some political control over the city of Shanghai. So there was a little bit of the violation of the sovereignty in China. But on the positive side, then there was a very diverse community there. And so you had people from all over the world living in Shanghai, and it was called the Paris of the Orient at the time. It had a really active jazz scene, for example. But it also had an underworld with a lot of opium trading and whatnot. And the largest organized crime syndicate in Shanghai was run by the man who was also the Chinese government's commissioner for suppressing opium. So what he actually did then was he suppressed every other gang except his own. So there was a lot of corruption in Shanghai as well. And I thought that was a really good setting for a murder. And so I put a mystery there.
Well, it sounds like an exciting period.
Yeah.
Can we expect more from either series?
From both, actually. Yes, I have several books planned in both series.
Anything in the works?
Yes, I am actually working on book 3 in the Shanghai series right now. It takes place in 1937, which was the year of the Japanese invasion. And so I have a body that is found in the war zone that has clearly been not killed in battle. And it's an American victim.
When did you first develop your interest in writing? What authors or novels inspired you?
Oh, gosh. So I started writing from very young, and I think I got involved in mysteries particularly because one of my early favorites was the Encyclopedia Brown stories. And then from there, I went on to the Hardy Boys. I read several Hardy Boys stories when I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. I kind of devoured them. And so those, I think, kind of got me into mysteries. And then as I got a little bit older, I read a lot of Agatha Christie because she was one of my mom's favorites. And so those kind of inspired me. And then probably late high school is when I really discovered historical fiction as its own category. And I think the book that I would credit as getting me involved in historical fiction was North and South by John Jakes. It was a big novel, but I tore right through it. And it was a novel that had inspired a miniseries that had been on a few years before that. And I was always a bit of a Civil War buff too. So that really got me into reading historical fiction. And so when I started writing seriously as I grew up, it was just kind of natural for me to want to set mysteries in the past.
I got to say, Encyclopedia Brown used to make me so angry because I could never, I could never solve the crime. And not too long ago, I was reading something like one of the Encyclopedia Brown books at the library. And I'm like, why couldn't I figure these out? You know, they weren't that hard, but boy, when I was a kid, they were difficult.
Yeah, they were. I remember that. He was so smart.
Yeah, he was smart. Encyclopedia was his name.
Yep.
Are there queer crime novelists that have inspired you?
You know, it took me a long time to discover any. It was one of those things that I erroneously thought that this was a genre that didn't exist and that I was writing something that there wouldn't be a market for. At least that was my fear for a long time. And it was probably about a year ago I got hooked up with the gay mystery group on Facebook and discovered that there are quite a lot of them. So just really in the last several months, I've kind of discovered Marshall Thornton, for example, Gregory Ashe, Garrick Jones, and there are a whole bunch of others I've got in my to-be-read pile. But those are the three that I have read so far and have enjoyed.
Yeah, that group has been great. In fact, Justine and I talked about it earlier. It helped me. I was like you. I didn't realize that any gay genre existed other than romance. I knew that was around and erotica. But when I discovered there were other genres such as mystery and suspense and thrillers, it was very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Because I knew that's what I wanted to write, but I didn't know mm-hmm. that anybody would read it.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm very excited to read a lot more of it. And it's also given me confidence to know that, yes, absolutely, there is a market for this and a fairly sizable one.
Well, who's your favorite underappreciated novelist?
Underappreciated. Probably my favorite mystery writer is William Kent Krueger. He's a Midwestern mystery writer from Minnesota, and he's pretty well known, I think, here in the Midwest, but I don't know how well known he is in other parts of the country. He writes a series of mysteries that are all set in the North Woods of Minnesota with a character whose name is Cork O'Connor. He's a sheriff, and there's a whole series of mysteries there that I really love.
I've never heard of William Kent Krueger.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to add him to my very extensive pile of books to read. Someday I'll get to them.
My pile is so huge, we won't even talk about it.
Yeah, I understand. Well, let's talk about reader reviews.
Okay.
Have you ever learned anything from a negative review and incorporated it into your writing?
I have not. I try not to read reviews too much. There's been a lot of warning about that on social media from experienced writers. They say, don't read your reviews. And reviews are for readers. They're not for writers. And I know that's actually a great debate because there are other writers that say that they do read the reviews. I try not to, honestly.
I don't think that's a bad idea. There's other writers I've talked to that do the same and write what you want to write.
Yeah. I glance at them to see that they exist and more or less what my average star rating is, and that's kind of the extent of it.
Yeah, I think it's next to impossible not to do that.
Yeah.
At least that much. What do you consider the hardest part about writing?
Finishing.
Go further in that.
Oh, yeah. I love starting a story and getting an idea for one and developing it. And I love diving into the characters. And I'm really more of a pantser than a planner, although I will do a little bit of planning, just basic bare bones outline. But really, I love kind of discovering as I go when I write and let the characters tell me what they're supposed to do within this very broad frame that I've set for them. But that does sometimes make it hard to come up with a satisfying ending. And that's, I think, the hardest part for me.
Well, I am in awe of anybody that's a pantser, and especially a mystery writer, to be able to get the story and the clues and your suspects without laying that out in advance. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I do a little bit of the planning, especially for the mysteries. I do find it helpful to do a little bit more planning than what I'll do for other types of stories, but I really do try to just discover as I go.
It all matter what works for you.
Yeah. And it's going to be different for everybody.
Well, I tell people when people ask me what's the right way to do it, and I'm like, well, Stephen King is a pantser and J.K. Rowling's a plotter. They both seem to be doing pretty well to me.
Yeah. So. And I think you can vary up your methods with different stories, too. There are certainly books I've written that I've planned out a little bit more than others.
What I end up may be totally different than my original outline, but I got to have that to get out of the starting gate.
Yeah, I totally get that, especially with the mysteries.
What would you say has improved in your writing over the years?
Oh, boy. I guess just the overall quality and the way you put together a sentence and a paragraph and the way you can string suspense along, that's the kind of thing that takes practice. It's not something you learn overnight.
And for aspiring novelists out there, what advice would you give?
Read a lot. Read books about writing, of course, but just read a lot of fiction, particularly in the genre you want to write in, but any genre, really. The more you read, the more you're going to see what works and doesn't work in novels, and you can emulate that.
And it's really hard for a writer because you feel like, I don't know about you, I love to read, but when I'm reading, I'm like, I should be writing.
And
I have to force myself to sit down to it with a book, no matter how much I enjoy it. I'm like, I really should be writing.
And, you know, the truth is the majority of us have day jobs, so our time is somewhat limited, and we often have to make the choice between spending time writing versus spending time reading, and so I often find that I can't do both at the same time. I'll be writing for a while, and then I have to refill the well, so to speak, and I'll go read a couple of books, and then I can go back to writing for a while.
Well, let's learn just a little bit more about you. If I were to ask Martin Schuler, your character, about you, what would he say?
He'd say I was mean.
Mean?
Yes. Yes. I put
you
him
can't
in
have that many animals and be mean. Come on.
No, I'm mean to Martin, though, and I'm mean to Doug Bainbridge, the protagonist of my Shanghai series. I put them into really bad situations.
Isn't that fun?
It is, yeah. And that's probably the way I can get my meanness out without being mean in real life.
Well, to wrap it up, I want you to tell us one more historical story, if you have one.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of something that would be interesting. Well, there was actually something people don't necessarily know is there was an institute in Berlin from the late 19th century all the way up through the early 1930s that studied homosexual and bisexual behavior. And it was had one of the largest libraries of sociology and psychological studies of gay and lesbian men and women, and also transgender as well. And sadly, a lot of that was lost to the book burnings when the Nazis took over. But it was there was quite a study of that in Germany for probably close to 40 years.
Now, I'm curious, was that studied as a deviant behavior, as a psychological problem, or...
No, it was studied in a much more affirmative way. The Institute was founded by Magnus Hirschfeld, who was himself a gay man and identified it as such. And so they studied not only different sexualities, but different gender expressions as well in a very affirming and positive way, just trying to get to the scientific truth of it.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
Yeah. And again, something we don't hear about a whole lot. And very sad that it was lost. They had one-of-a-kind works that could never be reproduced, and they were thrown onto the bonfires.
Well, you would know more than me, but from talking to you, it sounds like there were moments in our history where we started to make advances, and then we fell back again.
Yes. Yeah. And in fact, interwar Germany would be one of those more stark places. There were very active gay communities in Hamburg and Berlin in the 20s and early 30s that then were violently suppressed in 1933 and 34. And then, of course, one of the things that doesn't often get mentioned about the Holocaust is that gay men and women were some of the earliest victims that were sent to the camps. And they wore pink triangles. That's how the pink triangle eventually came to be a symbol of liberation. But actually, in Nazi Germany, that was what gay and lesbian individuals wore, was a pink triangle. And that was their version of the yellow Star of David that the Jewish folk had to wear.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. As usual, time flew by.
Yeah, I enjoyed this. Thank you.
I think we could have had you on just to talk about more historical background, just a wealth of stories there.
I find it interesting. I hope other people do as well.
I'm sure they will. Well, thank you for being on.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.